Tagadas words.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I really appreciate that we're here. And just to acknowledge, there's a lot of other things you could be doing on a beautiful spring weekend, that's for sure. Working on the farm or the garden or going to Tacoma to help support the people who are locked up. Playing with your kids, all kinds of things we could be doing, relaxing. But I think it's good that we're here. Because even, as odd as our little tradition is, and Dogen that we're going to study, a little bit hard to understand, we actually need this, I think. I think it helps. At least I hope so. And I'm thinking a lot about Norman this morning, our founding teacher. And just a little bit of backstory on this particular event. At first, all that we did was we had our weekly sit, which is not much different than it is now, the Wednesday night sit. It goes Thursday then. And then three times a year in Bellingham and three times a year in Vancouver, Norman would come. And or another teacher sometimes in Vancouver, other than Norman. And we have Sesshin, you know? So just, you know what Sesshin looks like. Sitting and sitting and sitting and sitting. And Norman would give a talk. But, you know, it's in the middle of Sesshin and you're sort of half awake. And you know, the instructions really for the formal Dharma talk are just to treat the words just as like energy, you know, and just let them flow through you. You don't have to remember it or anything like that. And Norman, you know, is pretty interested in all kinds of texts and studies and teachings. And so he would bring up all kinds of interesting things, but we kept kind of feeling like, oh, we're not quite getting, you know, the material. Maybe that doesn't matter, but we're not quite getting it, you know. And so, and then I was also thinking at one point about the times I had lived at Green Gulch Farm and Tassajara, and some of us have lived at places like that. And there they have a daily routine with a fair amount of meditation, but also classes and study periods and times when you're studying texts and getting to talk about them. Because, of course, the formal situation in Sesshin is you don't really get to talk about it, which is a great advantage, too, you know? It's great to not talk to each other. And it's great to talk to each other. So at one point, we were talking to Norman and said, well, can we somehow do some kind of version of, like, having a class or a study period up here when you're up here? And he said, well, yeah, maybe one at a time, you know, like once a year probably be good. And so we created this kind of hybrid between Sesshin and, like, a seminar, you know, or a college class or something, study retreat or Dharma seminar. And so Norman did that for several years, and then when he started to cut back a little bit, he said, well, maybe Tim, you should do it now. And I was just reflecting this morning that this has not been very easy for me. Every time it came around again, I felt underprepared and unworthy, you know, what things one would feel. And sometimes that was literally true, like I literally didn't have enough time to prepare. And, you know, all the things I'd run around and do. Feels a little bit better now, but one time, it was maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it was also Dogen. Can't remember which piece now, maybe Only Buddha and a Buddha, did we do that? Anyway, I was like running around like crazy in the mindfulness work, and I had been to, like, Tacoma or somewhere. No, I'd been to a hotel near SeaTac Airport to do a seminar for psychologists at the Washington State Psychology Association meeting. And it was like barely, like it was the same week, I know, it was the same weekend as the study retreat. And the study retreat was Saturday and Sunday like it is. And so the presentation invitation at the psychologist was on Friday. So I went with my colleague and did this seminar on Friday afternoon near SeaTac. And on the way back, I stopped at a Starbucks with all my books. I got all my books with me, all my Dogen books. I was like drinking lots of coffee and trying to figure out what I was going to say the next day. So some of that was literally true. But this morning, I was realizing that actually the other thing that Norman was modeling for me and for all of us is that you don't have to have it all figured out. You know what I mean? That when he does talks and when I do talks, you know, I write it out and I think about it pretty carefully, and it's like this 30 or 40 minute chunk of time, and you can be pretty organized about that if you have a little bit of time to prepare. But this is like hours of exploration and discussion and texts that need some time. And so I was reflecting this morning that when he would come up to do this kind of seminar on a text, he would have some notes, you know, scribbled in the margins and stuff, you know. But he wouldn't have like 5 hours of scripted material ready to go and all the cross references figured out. And the other day I was also listening to Pema Chodron, you know. Everybody loves Pema Chodron. Do you love Pema Chodron? Mm-hmm. Everybody loves Pema Chodron. And I was listening to this talk, and she was making all kinds of like sort of citations and connections without having looked it up or having it quite straight. And some of them are actually not exactly right, you know, but it doesn't matter, you know. You know, it's the spirit of it, right? And we can always go look it up later. Yeah. I forgot one of it. One of them I knew to be wrong, actually. But she was like, I think it's kind of like this. And you know, like, oh, that's right, Pema, but that's okay, you know. It's a good point. So let's enjoy Dogen and relax about whether we've got it all figured out, and I'll try to lead the charge by not having it all figured out. And so Dogen, were all you at least one or more of the Wednesday night? I've been giving some talks on Dogen. Has everyone been exposed to Dogen? I don't want to spend too long on his backstory because we could be here forever. But really an interesting and deep thinker. And he wrote in lots of different forms, and in his writings kind of folded together lots of different sensibilities and teachings. And so the text we're going to look at today is unusual in that way, because he was riffing on a traditional set of instructions for monastic practice called the Shanyuan Xingui, which means the rules of purity for Chan. Chan monasteries or Chan practice. So there was a manual. You know, Dogen read a manual, and I don't know if that manual was available to him in Japan or if he brought it back from China. I don't know if that's known or not. He didn't like make a list of what he brought back from China, so nobody really knows. But he's riffing on that, but then he's inserting all kinds of other material. So he's talking about how, in this case, how to be the cook of the monastery, which, based on his personal experience in China, he found to be a really important practice, the practice of being the head cook. But then he's inserting koan stories and his feelings and thoughts and little pointers and tips. He's kind of zooming out to really more philosophical ideas like we looked at in Bendawa on Wednesday nights lately, and then he's zooming into very particular details about how you should plan the menu and how you should take care of the ingredients. So it's really a fascinating text in that way. And all of this is pretty recently available to us in English. Now there's tons of versions and translations. And the translation I want to hand out now, which I will hand out now, is by a small group of English-speaking scholars. This is T. Griffin Folk, who's called Griff by his friends. And I've met a couple of them, and many of them I've read. There's like four or five American and Japanese scholars who are like, that's like somehow all they do. I don't know how their university, you know, it's like, I guess it's like the academy lives on, you know. We still can have people doing interesting and obscure scholastic work. So this is a translation by him, and what I like about it is there's a small and growing collection of these kind of more scholarly translations. We got it figured out? You know, you want this one too. It's different than what was on the website. Yeah, this is different than what I put on the website. I've changed it. So have both. Have both. So if you were like so diligent and downloaded and read it from the website, thank you, congratulations, then this one's different. It's the same translator, I just made some additions. A lot of the first translations, a big set of the first translations were by a Japanese man, an artist really, named Kaz Tanahashi. Just a little bit more backstory on Dogen studies in the West. And what's interesting about Kaz Tanahashi is that, well, for one thing, he's kind of self-taught. He didn't, like, you know, go to do lots of advanced studies in ancient Japanese or anything like that. He's a kind of genius, self-taught genius. And the other thing that's interesting about Kaz is that he lived in America a really long time. He's Japanese, lived in America a long time, and had lived at San Francisco Zen Center a long time. And he sort of invented a new way of doing translation. Maybe it'd been done by other people, but he sort of invented it, where he would look at the ancient Japanese and the modern Japanese translations of Dogen, which happened in the 30s and 40s. They like tried to figure out the weird way that, you know, it's like Old English and Modern English. So they did a modern Japanese translation, I think the 30s and 40s. So Kaz would look at those and write kind of pidgin English, you know, said he important principle five, you know, ranks or something like that, you know. And then he'd collaborate with experienced American Zen teachers and students and kind of try to work that into meaningful English that somehow touched on the feeling of what they thought Dogen was trying to say. And all Japanese and Chinese is hard to translate into English anyway. Just there's so many differences in syntax and style and structure. But then Dogen's extra tricky, as we'll see. So anyway, the first book of these that came out in 1985, so that's not that long ago, you know. And this is called Moon in a Dewdrop, and probably this is still a classic and a good book to have. And it's got smatterings of Dogen's work from his set of more philosophical essays, Shobogenzo, and also smatterings of the more practical pieces that Dogen wrote to guide the monastics, including this one, Tenso Kyoken, Dogen's Instructions to the Cook. But then also other bits and pieces, like poetry, and when Dogen gave formal talks, it's believed that he probably had notes, but he didn't write out his formal talks, but his students would run back to their rooms and try to write them down. So some of his formal talks in here, but I want to just share with you now one of the poems, my favorite. So anyway, it's not all, you know, like dense stuff. There's also poetry. And he wrote in multiple different styles of poetry too. Anyway, awake or asleep in a grass hut, what I pray for is to bring others across before myself. Although this ignorant self may never become a Buddha, I vow to bring others across because I am a priest. Beautiful, huh? Or you can think because I am a person, you know, or a student of Dharma. Awake or asleep in a grass hut, what I pray for is to bring others across before myself. Although this ignorant self may never become a Buddha, I vow to bring others across because I am a priest. So, you know, there's his intention, you know, in writing all this stuff. So, anyway, our hope this weekend is not just of me talking or even just Dogen talking, but have all of us interacting and reflecting. Not in this morning session, but I think in the afternoon session we'll do something that involves a little bit of writing, so between and then we'll try to all round up pens, and maybe there's some extra paper around here if you didn't bring a notebook. You know, and I sometimes manage some sort of weird hands-on experiential stuff, like one time we did sketching, and another time we did calligraphy. We'll see what happens. So, anyway, and so the periods are longer, so please don't feel too bound by the usual conventions of, you know, Dharma talks. If you need to move or stand up or stretch, and if something doesn't make any sense, you know, please interrupt me with a question, and I'll try to remember to break out for lots of times to discuss and comment. And I don't have the schedule in front of me. T, would you remind us, or somebody with the schedule? There's one. How long do we have right now?
11:50.
Okay. So we got another 55 minutes. That's great. All right, so what I've done here in this new handout is I took Griff's translation and I broke it into sections, and I made up these sections, and I made up the titles of the sections. And this really helps me to sort of be able to find my way and stay oriented in the text. And it's a helpful thing to do for yourself, too. But in this case, since, you know, I got the gig, you get my version. But you could do your own. And you might break it to different places or think of different titles and topics for what he's trying to say. Because the original texts in Asian languages usually don't have sections or chapters, and you'd be lucky if they even have punctuation. It's It's usually just great pages and pages and blocks of characters, you know. And you figure out in the context of reading it what, you know, how it's divided and separated. So this was written by Dogen not too long after he had returned to Japan and was teaching now independently in 1237. So conveniently, he was born in 1200, so he's 37 years old. And it's probably the third or the fourth major piece of writing that we know about that he did. Probably lots has been lost, too. First, he wrote a version of Fukan Zazengi that we chant here in the morning sometimes. Then he wrote Bendowa that we looked at, and then some other stuff. And now he's at his second small temple just outside of Kyoto, the capital. Or I guess it would be called Hiei or something like that. And he's trying to get organized, right? He's trying to figure out how does he want to organize his monasteries and all this. And this is just a little before he moves to Eheiji to really go out in the mountains. So it's kind of a transitional time in his career. And there's lots you can say and sort of guess about his career, and there's lots of theories. This is like a whole field, you know, Dogen studies is a whole field. So he's a pretty rich character. So anyway, let's just start reading. And we're going to get to an interesting koan before too long, which will be a good occasion to break out and discuss. So I think at first I'll just read out loud, and if you can choose whatever your learning style is, if you want to read with your eyes or just listen. This might be unrealistic, but my vain hope is we'll actually read every word of the whole text. We'll see. We might need to skip some stuff towards the end, you know, we're like, whoops, we're behind. And that's actually a traditional part of Dharma teaching, is you spend way too long like on the title in the beginning, and then you have to kind of rush through the end. So that's traditional. Usually, like the Tibetans are best at this, and I've been to a few of these. The Tibetans really are into texts, you know, and they go very carefully through them. And usually the entire first talk, which is often 2 or 3 hours long, you know, it's not like just, and then it really is just, you know, listening. Usually the entire first talk is just on the title, but we'll skip that. It just means instructions to the cook. So, section one, the overview. Buddhist monasteries have, in principle, 6 stewards, so 6 important officers. All are disciples of Buddha, and all carry out the work of Buddha. Among them is the officer known as the cook, the tenzo, who is in charge of preparing meals for the assembly of monks. The rules of purity for the Chan monasteries, Chan Yuan Xingyui, says, in order to provide nourishment to the monks of the community, there is a cook. From ancient times, the position has been assigned to senior monks who have the way-seeking mind, eminent persons who have aroused the thought of awakening. In general, the job of cook is an all-consuming pursuit of the way. If one lacks the way-seeking mind, it will be nothing but a vain struggle and hardship without benefit in the end. The rules of purity for Chan Monastery says, one should maintain a way-seeking mind, make adjustments in accord with the occasion, and see to it that the great assembly receives what is necessary and is at ease. In days of yore, monks such as Guishan and Dungshan performed this job, and various other great ancestral teachers did too at some point in their careers. Thus, it is surely not the same as the work of worldly cooks, imperial cooks, and the like. So right away, this is worth reflecting on, I think, a little bit. That ordinary stuff, like being the cook, is not ordinary, you know? So here, like, I think the title I ambitiously put on our weekend is Awakening in Everyday Life or something like that, right? So that everything we do, you know, has a depth to it. So not just to hire, you know, some cook from the village and give them your menu, but to consider it deep spiritual practice. And this next part gets a little bit more personal because his style of learning about this was, which we'll see, was both, you know, to read about it and experience it as a student, you know, as a monk enrolled in a monastery, big monastery in China, but also to talk to people, you know, and really to listen to people. Like, how do you understand what's going on here? So he goes on, when this mountain monk, you know, Dogen, so this is a little bit more literal translation. So when there's square brackets, you know, at this convention. It means the translator is adding words that weren't actually there so that it makes more sense. So all Dogen wrote was this mountain monk, and he means himself. Was in Song, China, on my days off. I inquired of retired elderly monks who had held minor and important offices. You know, so both minor and important offices. And they shared something of their views with me. Their explanations are the bones and marrow bequeathed by the Buddhas and ancestors who were possessed of the way in ancient times. As a rule, one should carefully read the rules of purity for Chan monasteries, and after that, one should pay heed to the detailed explanations of those retired senior officers. So, especially listen to your elders, you know, listen to your elders. And as we'll see quite a bit later, there's a story in here of one of his first encounters with one of these guys. And he comes off as kind of a cocky young thing, you know. You know. And he learns, you know, from his elders. So Dogen also could kind of be he had lots of different personalities like we all do. And sometimes he comes off as a total know-it-all kind of hard-ass character. And other times he comes off as quite tender and sweet, you know, and humble. So we'll see both phases of Dogen in this text. Let's keep plowing on a little bit longer here. So, section 3, the daily routine of the Tenzo. First, following the midday meal, so we're going to get into the details. Following the midday meal, go to the offices of the prior and comptroller and get the ingredients for the next day's meals, rice, vegetables, and so on. Having received them, protect and be frugal with them, as if they were your own eyes. Chan Master Yong of Baoning Monastery said, "Protect and be frugal with the monastery property, which is like your own eyes. Respect and value them as if they were ingredients for an imperial repast. These cautions apply to fresh and cooked things alike." So this is a famous imagery that Dogen brought forward, but he's quoting it from someone else. What if we were to treat everything like our own, like holding our own eyeballs, which to us sounds like a really creepy image, but you know what he means, right? Like that much tenderness and care with something that fragile, you know, and that important as our own eyes. Next, the various stewards consult in the store hall, what does that say, stone hall? Store hall, about what seasoning should be used on the following day, what vegetables should be eaten, how the rice gruel should be prepared, and so on. The rules of purity for Chan monasteries say, when deciding about ingredients as well as the flavors and numbers of side dishes for meals, side dishes, by the way, is like the condiments, you know, first consult with the stewards in the store offices. The stewards referred here are the prior comptroller, assistant comptroller, rector, cook, and labor steward. When the flavors and numbers have been decided, write them on the announcement boards in the abbot's quarters, common quarters, and elsewhere. And by the way, here's another challenge of translation, is like the translator has to decide what English words to use for all these Japanese names of offices, and their Japanese versions of Chinese words too, all the more confusing. In this case, the rector is the Ino, and the other ones are also other kinds of titles which we may or may not have heard of, because we're quite simplified here from the full meal deal. But if, you know, if they translated it as the Ino, then anybody not hanging out at the Zen places would be, what the heck is that, you know? I-N-O. I know? So anyway, doesn't matter too much, but just to know.
Is it labor steward the soku, or?
Soku. Yeah, probably. Or, you know, we say work leader sometimes. Soku. Yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah, I'm sure a lot of these, probably, if we heard the Japanese name, we'd recognize it. And there's also, we have another text, which is, some, if you want to dig into this stuff, Chris, or anybody does, there's another text we have access to, which is a modern Soto Church rituals manual. And I have a version of that where it's both these English versions and the Japanese versions, so we can kind of cross-reference, so I can find it for you. Very detailed and very, very boring. But we should probably break it out and get familiar with it at some point. It has detailed explanations of every single ceremony that one can do in Zen, but it's always in the context of a big monastery with lots of officers and stuff. Anyway, but the interesting point for us here is that it's a very cooperative and kind of community arrangement here. So the Tendo doesn't just kind of set his menu and go to Safeway, you know. He receives whatever's available from one officer, and a lot of that's probably donated or grown in the monastery fields. And then he has to consult with all the other officers about, well, what should I make, what should we eat, you know. And there are lots of rules and guidelines about that. So there's a kind of constraint on individuality and this great sense of each person taking a lot of responsibility. So the Tenzo has a big job, but he or she doesn't just get to do whatever they want either. After that, ready the next morning's rice gruel. When washing rice, preparing vegetables, and so on, do so with your own hands, with close attention, vigorous exertion, and a sincere mind. Do not indulge in a single moment of carelessness or laziness. Do not allow attentiveness to one thing result in overlooking another. Do not yield a single drop in the ocean of merit. Even a mountain of good karma can be augmented by a single particle of dust. So your mind really matters. Your mind really matters. The Rules of Purity for the Chan Monastery says, if the six flavors are not provided, then it cannot be said that the cook has served the assembly. And I wrote down somewhere what the six flavors are. I'll find that for you. When examining the rice, first check for sand. When examining the sand sifted from the rice, first check for rice. If you pay careful attention to detail, watching when coming and watching when going, then your mind cannot be scattered, and the food will naturally be replete, and the three virtues endowed with the six flavors. So now he's going to try to explain how to pay attention by citing a Zen story. So here's the great and confusing thing about our Zen tradition, that so much of it is communicated with stories, which don't exactly explain, you know, in the conceptual way that our minds would kind of want things to be explained, but challenge us to kind of enter into a kind of mythic space and interact with these different characters. And we were looking at a different Dogen piece, the group of us yesterday actually, and Chris had a great little point. She emailed me later, if you don't mind if I share this, that it's kind of like you poke at these stories. And your poking's a lot more productive if there's a group of us poking. And then sometimes meaning just sort of flows out of it. I forget how you said it, but meaning just sort of emerges, you know. So it's a little bit like that, you know. So here's a story about a former cook, you know, about a Tenzo. When Zhui Feng resided at Dongshan Monastery, he served as a cook. One day, when he was sifting rice, Master Dongshan asked him, "Are you sifting the sand and removing the rice, or sifting the rice and removing the sand?" Xuefeng said, "Sand and rice are simultaneously removed." Dongshan asks, "What will the Great Assembly eat?" Xuefeng overturned the bowl. Dongshan said, "In the future, you will go and be scrutinized by someone else." So let me say a few words, and then what I'm going to do is invite us to break into groups and explore some themes here. And one theme right away here is the theme of sifting. So you might have noticed I gave some words during the first period of Zazen, thinking a little bit about this with you. There's a way that we're always trying to sift things out, right? And there's stuff in every situation that is, you know, we like or we don't like, or is helpful or is unhelpful. And literally here, I guess, since the rice, you know, came from the rice fields, it wasn't super clean. Like, everything's like so processed and organized for us. You know, you buy a bag of rice, you're not worried about getting the sand out of it. Bags of beans, does bags of beans sometimes have little stones in them still? Yeah, so maybe bags of beans are that for us still, you know. It's not reasonable for the farmers and the producers to get every tiny little stone out of the bag of beans, but anyway, so we have something in front of us that has this mix, you know, and how are we to interact with that? Is it a matter of sifting out and removing you know, pulling out the stuff we like to gather a little pile of the things that we like. It's a matter of extracting and removing the things that we don't want to be there, the sand in this case. And Dogen's saying that we need to pay attention when we're doing this. We can do this very automatically. But our hope here as practitioners is to pay more attention to how we do this and what the spirit is that we bring to this. And is it right to think that the sand is good or is bad and the rice is good? And Xuefeng is the student here in this story. And Dungshan is a little confusingly both the name of the place and the name of the teacher. Shan means mountain, and the monasteries were usually on some degree of mountain. Although the mountains were sometimes not really like beautiful crags like you picture in your mind. Like this is kind of like, it'd be like this place here, you know, we're kind of on a little slope of Siom Hill. That's like enough of a mountain, you know. And so if we were a little more traditional, this would be like Siom Mountain Monastery. And you'd call me Siom. From now on, you know. And so then what's cool is then you get this double meaning, you know, have you been to Siom, you know? So it could refer to the mountain, it could refer to the monastery, it could refer to the teacher, or sort of like all three. We made a great joke about this one time. Norman gives a retreat every year with Kate and Michael, you know, of Loon, of Mountain Rain in Vancouver, in a place called Loon Lake. So one time I was up there and we said we need to call him Loon. He took that in good spirit, I thought. Yeah. I don't know if we really called him that. We said we should. So, but here, the kind of taking a step. So, and then you get kind of lost in the details, like what are they even talking about? And then, what is Xuefeng? Is Xuefeng just trying to avoid this issue, you know? This issue of picking and choosing? And picking and choosing is a famous Zen theme, right? And a very famous Zen story, which is from very early in Zen. So these stories are mostly from the 9th and 10th centuries and into the 11th century, which is a period of China called the Tang Dynasty. And Dogen, when Dogen was in China, was in the sort of next dynasty, the Song Dynasty. So the Song Dynasty people are always thinking about the Tang Dynasty people, but even before the Tang Dynasty people, the so-called second patriarch of Zen wrote a famous poem that starts out, the great way has no difficulties, just avoid picking and choosing. So it's always a reference to that whenever there's picking and choosing. And so that's a great guide for life, right? Our great life is no problem. You know, living in this modern world is no problem, not a problem at all. Just avoid picking and choosing, no problem. And of course you can't avoid picking and choosing. And so already we have this kind of tautology. So Xuefeng responds to this question, like, well, what do you do with this tautology of picking and choosing, what you like, what you don't like, sand, rice, is it, which way are you going with all this? And we were talking about politics this morning, same thing, you know. We were talking about, you know, on one hand, we need to somehow stay positive and human and connected in the face of the national political scene. On the other hand, it's full of, like, really fucked up sand, right? You know, there's some real problems here. And so Xuefeng said, well, good and bad are simultaneously removed, are simultaneously present, are simultaneously okay. And Dongshan brought, and they're moving back and forth between symbolic and literal in interesting ways. Dongshan saying, okay, so you want to get all symbolic about this? Well, what about lunch? You know, you're the cook. Are we eating sand? Are we eating rice? What will the assembly eat? And Xuefeng just took the bowl where, in which, you know, it's like a big wide, it's like a wide kind of bowl or a wide basket where he was kind of moving the sand to one side and the rice to the other side, presumably, just took it and dumped it over. Probably had a lot of other bowls around, you know, it's not like the whole supply, you know, as a symbolic act of what, you know, of letting go. So, and let's reread Dogen's commentary, and then I'm going to invite us to do a little reflection, meditation, and then break into groups and see what we can make of all this. So the previous paragraph before, so did you notice this? Dogen set this up, and then he told us the story. And he's going to come back to it again many times. So first, the previous paragraph, the end of section 3, right after that quotation. When examining the rice, first check for sand. When examining the sand sifted from the rice, first check for rice. pay careful attention to detail, watching when coming and watching when going, then your mind cannot be scattered, and the food will naturally be replete with virtues and endowed with flavors. Let's not worry about the list right now. And then he quotes this story. Let's take a one minute stretch break first. We've been sitting here a while already. And you're welcome to do that anytime this weekend. A little distracted with your zazen, but that too. Sit comfortably and settle ourselves for a moment. Lowering the gaze or even closing the eyes all together if you like. So we can kind of drop into our own sort of heart space. And I want to invite this contemplation of the rice and sand of our lives to our own selves, because it's so easy for us to externalize. And feeling the breath in the body and staying connected to that feeling. I invite you to bring to mind, or just ask the question and breathe with the question, what are some of the things that you appreciate about yourself? What are some of the things that you appreciate about yourself? This could be qualities that you exhibit, or aspirations you have, values you carry. Could be things that you, actions you take, quality, you know, just anything. And the invitation here is really let these come into our minds, and, you know, the inner critic is never far away, so let her relax a little bit. And just be curious about what are the qualities and aspects of myself that I appreciate. Kind of like just tossing that question out there and listening with the breathing to what comes back. Like there's a quiet voice somewhere watching you who's going to answer you. If they do, you know. What are some of the qualities of myself that I appreciate? What are my good qualities? And bringing curiosity to this, not who knows what we'll think of, you know? Might not be the usual things we think of. And then let's let that question go and just drop, release, relax into the feeling of breath and body. Hearing the sounds around us, our presence in the room. Resting into this quality of just being here. including whatever it is we're feeling, if there's emotion here, or tension or relaxation in the body or mind or the heart. Just being with what is. And now let's breathe with the other side of the equation, with the grit of our life, the grittiness of our person, and being very gentle with ourselves in this, because we're not always so kind. What are some of the gritty edges? You know, what are some of the qualities of yourself that you wish were different? You know, that you have hope for change and growth in? Bring some attention to what the sand is, what the grit is in each of us. Qualities, habits, roughness, rough edges. Might just breathe with the question, what are my rough edges? Noticing if the attention goes off somewhere, or if we get into kind of beating ourselves up or something. It's more just asking the question and listening. What are the rough edges in me? Just gently being with that, breathing with that. Our spirit should be kindness here, not reprobation. And then with a sigh, maybe a little adjustment of the body, let's let that go. Just relax as best we can, back into breath and body. And let's sit with a little curiosity about how the mind engaged with those two questions. How did the mind work with seeking the rice and seeking the sand of our own person? How was that experience of noticing these two sides of every human being, this particular instance of a human being? Great, and raising the gaze. A little stretch might not be unwarranted. Yeah. Emotions always show up in the body, you know? We ignore them, but there they are. So I want to invite us to do a little conversation in groups of three, but let me just offer a few suggestions about how to go about these things. I mean, we mostly all know each other pretty well. You know, we're kind of like a Sangha family gathering here. But let's just remind each other that the intention when we're having conversations about Dharma, which are inherently somewhat personal, right? And that last reflection was completely personal. The intention is to have a safe space so we can explore these things out loud with kind listeners supporting our engagement, and to refrain from fixing and advice giving. We don't need to be fixed, you know, goodness gracious, you know. Let's remember that we're already perfect, just as we are, and we could use a little improvement, you know. But the agent of improvement is not other people telling us anything, you know. It's our own practice and our big hearts, you know. So, but anyway, yeah, the invitation here is to find a group of three, maybe we break into threes evenly, so not quite, maybe there'll be one group of four, I can't quite figure it out right now. And, what's that?
One group of four,
thank you. Thank you, mindfulness teacher in training, I simply calculate these things, that's great. So anyway, just for each person to speak a little bit and others to listen, and you know, and once you've kind of each person, I'm not going to control it too much, once each person's kind of gotten the floor with a sort of silent listening audience, then anything you want, any views or thoughts you want to exchange. But the main thing I'm interested in is, how does the mind approach sand and rice? How does the mind approach good and bad? And so it's hard to get a handle on this because it's so automatic, you know what I mean? We have our patterns and tendencies. But since looking at our own self is pretty tender and activating, sometimes we can kind of see something. So you don't need to share the details of what your good qualities and terrible qualities are, but if you want to say some examples, that's fine, up to you. But mostly just if, as much as we can kind of explore together, how did it feel and where did the mind, what happened internally when the mind was invited to notice the good and to notice the not so good, you know what I mean? Did it skitter off? Did it get excited? Did it get agitated? Did it get really interested or like check out completely? What? He asked about that? I don't remember that, you know? That happens, you know? Right? What? You know? Because the mind's always doing that, right? It's always interacting with things we like and things we don't like, you know, in certain ways, which is what he's kind of getting at a little bit here with the example of rice and sand. Okay, let's just try. We'll see what happens. Find some partners. Somebody agree to go first, and we'll just see what happens. And I am recording just my remarks, so I'm going to turn it off for these conversations. You know?